meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Majority Rights Radio. I'm GW. It's been a long time since we did some work in this medium. But we're going to put that right today by resuming our interview series right here. And we're going to make this a nice, safe starter for me as interviewer, because I've never done this before. And I wouldn't relish inflicting my greenhorn broadcasting skills on anyone less forgiving than my guest today, who is my friend and colleague at MR, Soren Renner.
I think you're being unduly optimistic, GW.
Yeah.
I think that, in fact, I am likely to prove the most prickly and refractory guest you could have chosen for your initial dive into the cold waters.
It has taken 2 years, Soren, actually, since I first mooted the possibility of interviewing you, because it was something that I said I would do right at the very beginning, quite a while ago now, more than 2 years.
But who's counting?
Well, yeah, okay, fair enough. Soren, you are an enigma to a lot of people. I hope you know that, and I hope you don't mind if I'm slightly critical of you, because
I don't think that. I don't.
A lot of your thoughts get lost in translation, in my opinion.
I think that people don't pay any attention to me. I don't think that makes me an enigma.
Well,
I
think it's a fact that your way of addressing things is, for a lot of people, is very elusive and incomplete. You are a gesticulator. Your form of communication is quite often something that people have then got to go and extend themselves a lot to try to understand.
Wait, you're saying that people need to see my hand movements to understand what I'm saying?
I really don't want to see your hand movements, no. But you know what I mean.
So that was what you mean by gesticulation.
I think of all of the poetry, I think of the odd little films that you've shot, and some of them pass me by.
Well, Constantine writes poetry, and
somebody calls
him an enigma.
Soren, the thing is, what we've got here is a very unusual individual. That's what you are, a most unusual man who's highly intelligent, very subtle in your thinking, well-educated, who, for some reason or other, doesn't quite explain in clear language so that us minions can really get to grips with what it is you're trying to tell us. And that's something that I'd like to try to resolve now so that we can go over some of the main planks in your intellectual life and really get them right out.
Before you ask any questions, I should say that probably you could clear all this up for yourself if you just read a very short, it's like 2 pages long, essay by Paul Valéry, the French poet, symbolist poet, called The Aesthetic. It's an essay, The Aesthetic Infinite. It's his basically theory of aesthetics, the origin of aesthetics. And it's very short, and it's very it'll clear everything up for you. But go ahead with your question.
Well, maybe aesthetics isn't the correct approach to the question of racial preservation. But there we go.
Ah. So ethics has nothing to do with it?
Ethics or aesthetics?
You don't understand that they're related?
No, I don't understand that they're related. To me, an aesthetic is a question of presentation, whereas an ethic is a question of principle, isn't it? Are you telling me that presentation and principle are related? Not very intimately.
I'm telling you that if you think there is a clear distinction between aesthetics and ethics, then you haven't gone very deeply into the matter.
Oh, fair enough. I'll plead guilty to that. But it's not where I want to go now. What I want to do is to cover in quite a superficial way from your natural way of approaching things.
Shall I be glib then?
Soren.
Shall I be glib then?
Soren, I just want you to give me good, clear answers. So let's start with a question which I know you know is coming, and that's the ideological background you had as a younger man at college. And obviously something that must have involved, I guess, a degree of environmentalism or an approach to it that would suit perhaps Mr. Harding and Mr. Hubbard. But tell us where you came from when you first arrived at MR and how your thinking has moved on from that point.
Well, the original form of this question that you asked was supposed to include something about my having a different ideological background from most of the people at MR.
Yes.
But I was prepared to answer that question, and since you answered it, you asked it without that part, I'm now confused.
Okay.
Can you go back and ask it the way that it was supposed to be asked? I have no objection to being asked questions that I've never seen before, but I do.
You're
going to
be asked questions you've never seen before. That's an inevitability of being
interviewed.
When
you sent this question to me, and I was expecting to answer it as it was written.
All right. Well, let's cut the thing in half then, and we'll start with the second half of the question, and then we'll see if we can get you back on the first half. Second half of the question is that when your arrival at MR, you were certainly not a conservative bod like me, and you were, I think, not a racialist like some of the others. Fairly widely read, of course. I mean, you understood the scientific arguments very well. But it's not clear to me exactly what your views were when you arrived. And I would be fascinated to know what they were at that point and how they changed, how quickly they changed.
Well, you can't expect a mature dragonfly to be interested in the state of its wings when it was just wriggling out of the casing and molting. So I don't, the question of where exactly I was at particular points in time are not interesting.
Well, but they are. This is something which everybody who's in our situation should actually think about, because we're all engaged in trying to talk to pupae, and it does us a lot of benefit, I think, in that endeavor,
okay,
if we understand
Granted. But your question to me is, as I understood it, was going to be that the normal background for someone who came to MR was not the same as mine. And
I don't know what yours was. That's what I'm asking you.
My answer to that is I have no idea what other people's backgrounds were, or at least only a vague idea.
Now you're being evasive.
I have a vague idea that most people that end up as racialists, as revolutionary nationalists, started out being conservative. That's my vague idea. I think that most people came originally from being conservative. I think that at one point in time you considered yourself to be a conservative. I think that Alex thought of himself as a conservative at one point in time. I know that he did because he used to work for them in Washington, D.C. Not that he's an MR, but so that's not really
all. It's a general question, but you did not come from that background.
I did not. But as for the other posters at MR, you have a much clearer idea of who they are and what their backgrounds are than I do. James Bowery, for instance, I really don't think he was ever really a conservative.
Well, James can answer for James. We don't need to answer for James here.
Right.
I'm interested.
But I have never been any sort of conservative. At least I've never considered myself any sort of conservative. And this is an advantage in that I'm not still stuck in any form of conservatism. And many people who come to something approaching our view of the world have the problem that they're still confined by things that they remember from when they were conservatives.
And need to justify, in many cases.
They're not prepared to give it all up.
Mm.
And I imagine, I don't know if this is true, but I imagine that if I had always considered myself, I'm a conservative nationalist, say in the American context. I'm white, I'm a conservative nationalist. I imagine that coming to the realization that conservatism does not work and that only revolutionary nationalism has a chance of success.
Yes.
I imagine that revolutionary nationalism for such a man would be quite a bitter pill to swallow. And it might take a lot of effort to come over to that position. I'm not sure. I know that for myself, having never been any sort of conservative, I know that for me, revolutionary nationalism was not bitter. Was
right.
Not a pill,
let's,
and that I now think of it as
about,
something.
Let's try to nail you down a little bit.
This is a set piece. Let me get through it. Not bitter, not a pill, and not to be swallowed. For me, revolutionary nationalism is something to be spewed forth, something to be vomited out, something to be prolapsed.
Now
like
you've
the gut
gone back into aesthetics.
Prolapsed like the gut of a starfish.
Right.
Onto the alien molluscar
okay.
flesh of our hereditary enemy.
This is fascinating and colorful, but may not be all that enlightening. And this is a point which I'm trying to overcome in this interview. I want to enlighten people who are listening and say, what the hell is this guy about? So let's go back to what we were saying before. We've established what you were not, and I think that's obvious.
Right.
What we don't know is what you were.
I don't know. I don't think there was ever a word for it. I don't think that anybody – I have never really had a good, solid ideological place to stand until this final transition. This,
right.
You know, in my continuous mold, I never had a firm place to stand, and my position really didn't make sense to anybody else, and it didn't really make sense to me. And the reason was, of course, because it didn't make sense. You know, I'm reasonably well educated, but I always looked at the world and I thought, well, look at economics. I don't understand it at all. Wait, a deficit of trade is good for the U.S. to run, but it's bad. And it's bad, but it's good. You know, there seemed to be contradictory stuff in the realm of economics, in the realm of politics, political science. None of it made sense.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is, late in my life, I actually found out that it did make sense, and
right.
there was a reason, that there was actually a reason why the way that it was put forth and explained didn't make sense.
Right.
And the more intelligent someone is, the less sense it will make the way it's explained. And that's because it's lies. And it's not random lies to cover up the fact that they don't have a good explanation. It's directed lies designed to cover up the fact that they're trying to win.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah, which brings us back, well, something we're going to come to in a minute, which is the discourse is war element.
Yes. Discourse is war, and I'm glad you noticed it.
Oh, don't worry. There are some things, even about you, that are quite plain. But I want to carry on trying to get at the things that are not plain. Now, I mean, you spent a long time studying in university, and you came out of it, far as I can see, looking still for some understanding about the world. And that must have brought you at some point onto the internet, and you obviously were looking for a political understanding of the world because you arrived in the racialist part of the internet.
Ah, but what brought me there?
What brought you there?
The proximate thing that brought me there was, well, I'll tell you a little story. When George Bush was reelected, I found that tremendously upsetting. For some reason, I actually thought it would be better if Kerry was elected. Shortly thereafter, I realized that it wouldn't have made a difference.
No.
But in the aftermath of that election, I was just in a fairly bad mood, and I ran across a site containing essays by a man named Jay Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, called dieoff.org.
Right.
And he has another site now. He basically completed that site, you know, about 6 or 8 years ago, and it's just maintained. But there are a number of really good essays there, and they explain economics, the economics of peak oil. You know, Garrett Hardin, Limits to Grow stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Richard Duncan, Olduvai-Gorge theory.
Yes,
and I just got into all that stuff. Yeah, I ate all that stuff up, and I actually set myself the following problem. I said, well, Jay Hanson says, if there's a path to the better, it begins with a full look at the worst. Okay, well, let's look at the worst. And let's ask ourselves, how can we make it through the worst? If there is a surviving state in 100 years, a surviving civilization with human beings on this planet, and they have music and universities and, you know, something above the Neolithic and technology. In other words, if there's a surviving state in 100 years, let's assume that there is. And if I imagine myself now as a forerunner of that state and a pre-citizen of that state, what actions can I take to bring it about? The first thing I ask is, well, maybe I'm just delusional. Is this even possible that a man imagines a state in the future and acts as a citizen of that state to bring it about? Then I happen to run across a little diary by a man named Theodor Herzl, where I discovered that even though he was a self-proclaimed chatterer and dilettante, that he had basically done exactly this. So it's an existence proof, right? He said there should be the state of Israel should exist, and he was later acknowledged as having brought it about. Let's assume that's true. Well, it's possible then. How nice. So let's ask ourselves, what do we know about this state that exists in 100 years? If we posit that it's sustainable, that it can look forward reasonably, it can reasonably project hundreds or thousands of more years of continued existence without anything obvious which is contradictory. Anything which is, yeah.
Unstable.
So they don't have a gun to their heads at that point. What do we know about them? Well, let's see. What's the population on the Earth? And you just go around and ask people, set up this problem. You ask the ordinary man in the street, what's the population on the Earth in 100 years if there's a sustainable civilization that isn't going to have to decline from that point? And, you know, nobody's going to tell you 100 billion. not many people will say 10 billion or 5 billion. People are pretty consistent between one half billion and 1.5 billion. That's the answer you usually get. That seems reasonable to me. Anyway, it's a lot fewer than we have now.
Right.
So then I ask myself, what is the trajectory between now and then of history? Let's see. Suppose that the liberal democratic pieties are observed in this future state. John Rawls' theory of justice would perfectly apply to it. And let's even suppose what we know not to be the case, that these theories apply perfectly to our present world, which is, you know, obviously not true. Even in that case, is there a way to get from 7 billion people in a century down to 1 billion people while preserving as an invariant along that path the liberal democratic pieties? How does that work? So it's a game of musical chairs, and we're going to shoot people as the chairs disappear, but somehow we're going to do it in a just way. You know what? Suddenly, you begin to see that this is a political question.
Yeah.
Right? But here's the point. I didn't come to it from white nationalism or racialism.
No. I
came to those things because I realized that what you had to have in order to act now toward a surviving state, what you had to have was something like a nationalist or a religious idea that people could get interested in and excited by. I was describing this to a neighbor of mine named Sergei Zharikov over vodka. I was describing this to him in the course of a lengthy conversation. He said, "Dude, have you read Alexander Dugin?"
Mm-hmm.
I went off and I read Dugin. I said, "Yes, right. yes, this stuff."
And that's and where we were when we met, as it were.
Right. But here's the point. I actually came to the politics through the collapse issue. I didn't come to the collapse right. issue after racial politics.
Right. Thank you very much. You've now answered my question. Good.
Okay.
What I wanted to do was to move you forward because you'd arrived, you had some ideas, which were interesting ideas, which have stayed with you and have helped to form your general model of the world. But there happened at some point after you'd arrived in our presence, and not particularly from what you found here, but what you found elsewhere, which is you became much more radicalized, you became much more overt in terms of what you think of as the traditional white nationalist program, and you became interested in VNN and in Alex, and your world moved on again. So you'd incorporated a whole new range. I mean, this must have been something quite...
That's true, and there was something else important that happened that you're not...
Go on.
I actually met Nunke in the flesh.
Right.
It was another poster,
right.
Matt right. Nunke, who was a long-term poster at Jordy Wright's.
Yes.
And I sent him an email, and it turned out we lived in the same city.
Yes.
So we met up down by the Cloud Gate, and which you don't know.
Not really, no.
Are you at your computer?
No.
Are you at your computer?
I am, but I'm not going to start tapping away on it now.
All right. Well, the Cloud Gate is
it's
a sculpture. We call it. It's also called the Bean. It's an enormous stainless steel mirror. It looks like a giant bean.
Right.
Anyway, we met there. He's an older gentleman. He's been a large influence on me. He's very radical. I think probably from the stuff he writes, you don't see how extreme he is.
Right.
But he talks about morality all the time.
Yeah.
He doesn't write about it, but he talks about it.
Well, he should write about it.
Yeah.
Next time you see him, you should tell him to offer something on that. It'd be nice.
Well, why don't we – look.
Anyway, we're getting away.
Do a group show.
So you
– Yeah,
first
I listened
experience?
To Alex.
What was your first experience with JQ? You heard Alex.
Yeah, I think it was probably I heard one of his what was the name? I forget the name of his not Free Talk Live, maybe Free Talk Live, maybe it had another name. Goyfire. Yeah,
right.
I heard him
yes.
on one of his podcasts, and you know, Alex is more extreme in language than many people. He doesn't mind throwing around such indelicate language as the N word, for instance.
No,
and
I don't know the N word.
Oh, really?
No.
Really?
No, I mean the high moral tone we adopt.
Oh, absolutely.
Is covering know.
Yeah, yeah.
Middle class sensibilities, which don't extend to that kind of thing.
I first heard Alex, and my middle class sensibility said, "Oh, this is horrifying. this is horrifying. This is hateful." And then I listened to it, and I thought,
"No, it's a release."
Wait, no. This guy, unlike most of the people who talk like this, this man is very intelligent and is doing it on purpose. And once I heard the intentionality in the way he was talking, once I realized he was doing it on purpose and that, in fact, he was extremely bright, I was hooked. I liked him. And I started listening to him. And later I saw a few minutes of him in Byron Jost's film, The Line in the Sand, which is about illegal immigration into the U.S. And Alex is standing in the desert in a suit, wearing a green tie, talking for maybe 2 minutes in the middle of the movie. And he quotes Euripides, "A slave is he who cannot speak what he thinks." I mean, I don't even think he knew he was quoting was he Euripides? Anyway, the point is, no, I saw that he was on the list of 40 haters to watch from the ADL, or maybe the SPLC, and had a little picture of him. And I thought, you know what? Oh, I actually felt jealous. I actually thought, I wish I was on like a list of like white nationalist haters, you know, to be like included in the group hates that, you know, the ADL has. If you remember 1984, the group hates where they all together hate somebody. This is a strange feeling at the time because why would I want to be reviled? Why would I want to feel the execration of the crowd, like the guy
at the end? Because it's a liberation, I guess.
No, because I really think Alex is right about a whole bunch of stuff. I think he's right.
Yeah,
now,
okay.
Obviously, I do. And what's more, I have every intention of forcing you to interview him.
We'll think about that. The thing is that it's quite a distance between VNN and the oil drum. There aren't very many people, I suspect, at the oil drum who would be able to handle the VNN roughhouse.
There aren't many people at VNN who reason scientifically well enough to follow the discussion at the oil drum.
Right.
And now, if I had a criticism of Alex, it would be that he is not technical. He's not scientific. And this sometimes leads him to have opinions about things which actually need you to be scientifically minded in order to have a valid opinion about.
Right. I think I once compared, although nobody picked it up at the time, I once compared him to Leonides and Hot Gates. I mean, the man is singular and determined and willing to pay the price.
That's
the very, exceptional thing about him in my view.
He's very worth listening to on other, when he talks about other people in the movement. For instance, you could use an hour just listening to what he says about, like, you could listen to him for an hour on Bill White, Hal Turner, other people, because Alex, unlike many, many people in the movement, does not have a huge ego. Mm-hmm. Okay? And he doesn't mind saying, you know, this man did me wrong, this man is a lunatic, and yet I see good in him, and I think that something good for our people could come out of him a lot more easily than it could out of, you know, the Pat Buchanan conservatives. Mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, he has good things to say about people that he knows firsthand to be lying, psychotic, vicious, immoral people.
Okay, so let's get back to you. Now, you've moved very quickly, and I've seen this happen before. I saw it happen with Jeff Beck. You've moved very quickly.
We can talk about him later.
Yeah, okay. Through this pseudo-conservative world of MR, and you hit a place where people are saying, know them, hate them, fight them. You did this because you found that there was truth in what was being said.
Yes.
And that's our advantage. It was true that had made it impossible to say. So, okay, now you've got a model which is an interesting one. It's about die-off. It's about return of the group, I suppose. And survivability, anyway. Billions will die. We will survive.
Billions will die.
And then you arrive at, frankly, a pretty anti-Semitic explanation. Now, these two things just don't gel. How did you actually resolve the dissonance between them?
I don't know that I have an anti-Semitic explanation. In other words, I don't know that I In fact, I know that I do not attribute the crisis our civilization is in primarily to the presence of Jews in the human population. That isn't true.
Right.
There were internal conflicts in human technological civilization, and I don't see that the exact ethnic makeup of that civilization has anything to do with the internal contradiction, the contradiction in a world that has to keep growing indefinitely or begin to die.
So let's move on. Your next sort of sudden change of direction was towards the New Right. But it led you to London, and that led you on to meetings with a lot of other people who have been very useful. I mean, Norman, of course, you met there, and Kai, and some others.
Well,
so
it was blind ambition. It was blind ambition, GW. That's all it was.
All right.
I went to London because I wanted to meet the people at the top of the New Right, and I wanted to act and be accepted as and be seen as a peer of those people.
Right, okay. Well, I don't think you're doing yourself any justice, because I have another view of what you were doing, and to my mind was trying to bring forward an idea which you developed, a piece of original thinking, and that idea is summed up in
available
three words.
Available on YouTube?
Discourse is war, and it should still be
and
available on YouTube.
We should say that this is available as a speech in four or five parts on my YouTube page.
This is true, but it's the first part of the speech which I think is the most interesting part, and that's the part where you explain that you flip the accepted discourse about war, which is the Heraclitian and Clausewitz, this sort of thing.
Right.
And you come out with a much more evolutionary worldview that says, well, this is human nature. It can't be changed. It's embedded in us. And war is an expression of...
And people who say it's been repealed are fighting us.
Yes.
People that say, oh, okay, put down your guns. We're through playing with guns now. They're waiting for you to put your gun down so they can shoot you. That's what universalist morality is, right? We've all decided there's no more war. You put your gun down, they shoot you, right? Discourse is war. Universalism, the putting forth of universalist ideals, is war.
Is war.
Is an act of war.
Yeah. Yeah.
See,
well, this
is
very interesting, and I had a lot of potential in as a way of explicating the world. And I would very much have liked to have seen you expand on that and really run with that idea. But you didn't then develop it any further. I mean, we had these speeches.
Well, it was complete. I don't understand. How was I supposed to develop further? By giving another speech? I don't like to travel.
Well, by restatement, by deepening some aspects of it, things that happen to everybody. I mean, it's a fact that you have a particularly... annoying facility to state something perfect like a jewel of words, and then you're satisfied with that. This brings us back.
So I have the jewel, but I don't provide the dung.
Well, you are a jeweler. You are a jeweler. I mean, you make these beautiful little patterns that everybody looks at.
Right.
And
but where's the dung heap to set it off? Right.
So
what most people do is they come up with the jewel, and then they come up with a dung heap to surround it. So that they can add stuff out and come up with a complete book.
Most people who have an original idea then spend the rest of their lives repeating it in one form or another. That's the norm, and everybody comes to...
Well, I'm lazy, you see. I'm lazy because it's a lot of work. I'd rather just keep coming up with original ideas.
Well, let's try to explicate this one
a little bit nearer.
Now, what you said, you flipped the general ideas that are given to us about what war is, that it's something that is a bastardization of human life, and that we can really be done with it, we can put it away. You flipped all of that, said, no, that is human life, and the people who are telling us that it can be put away are actually trying to put us away. And this was something that hadn't, to my mind, been stated in those terms. It's nice and clear and neat, and it just needed to become embedded. And I don't feel that you gave it the opportunity for that to happen.
Well, you know, it's difficult for one man by himself to create an entire opera.
Yeah, you've got a website to help you.
To paint the sets, design everything, write the music, sing, dance. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, even Harry Parch couldn't do it by himself, right? I mean, so my point is, certainly if it was as good as all that, somebody else certainly could have picked it up and, like, quoted it and run with it. But
well, I think there was a lot that you could have done with it. I think that it could have been entered into your vocabulary, and it could have spread to the vocabulary of others. And I have not seen seen it used by anybody else. This is the thing, that there has to be traction with our ideas. This is when somebody says, well, why aren't you a conservative? Well, I was a revolutionary conservative in my own terms, but then I came to the conclusion that there was no such animal as a revolutionary conservative, and the only revolution was nationalist.
Well, but you're wrong. There are people. There's at least one commenter at Majority Rights who gets it, who understands everything I've written and everything I've said. There's at least one commenter, and you can, if you read his comments, it's quite clear.
Well, that's good. I want him
now,
to. I want him
it's
to do
your
what
job,
you want in that case.
It's your job to get him to write, because I've tried. I've said, look, write essays. I will get them published at Majority Rights.
He will when he's ready. I mean, he'll hear this and he'll know who we're talking about. And I think when he feels ready. It's not unusual for people to want to take time to come to this. It's a major commitment to somebody to take this on. It's a labor of love. It's not a small decision to take.
There's a difference between being yellow-wooded and lily-livered, let's say. No, that was something that only he'll understand.
Right, okay. So we have an idea that you'd fashioned. It's an idea about them and the lies that they tell about peace and about metaphysics.
And you see, you don't have to worry about who they are.
No, it's everybody.
Anybody starts talking about morality, about universalism, when anybody starts talking in that line,
that's them. Yeah.
You know, like, you know, when anybody starts talking about morality, like, make sure you know where your wallet is. same concept.
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, all of that comes down to a modus operandum of war. And an attempt to push us out of existence, I think, which was the words you used during the London speech. And that's a powerful
idea. All against all, an attempt on the part of everyone to push everyone out of existence, essentially.
Right. So this is beginning to reveal to me the man who was interested in what was being spoken about at the oil drum, as well as the man that was visiting VNN. So there's some kind of unity beginning to arise here. By the time you got into London, you were gradually achieving a synthesis. All right, okay, so we'll leave that then, and we'll move forward to the next, and as far as I can see, the final major stopover on your journey to date. And this returns to Dugin and his interpretation of the subject without confines. Now, this is a difficult subject, and a lot of people will have thought they understand something of it in the terms which, you know, they're able to. But the bottom line is Dugin's understanding of it is a very religious or spiritual understanding. And as such, it's quite different to anything that I see in your work. I mean, I can't see, as Dugin stands today, with this sort of a Russian Orthodox priest with a great beard, you know, speaking about, not about politics,
But that essay isn't recent by him. That's not from that period of his. But look, what you haven't said is that I talked about the subject without confines in a speech I gave last spring to the Hitler birthday party in Lyons, Illinois, organized by Art Jones and the National Socialist Movement something.
And it was a successful speech.
And I posted a link to it at Majority Rights, but I didn't post it. I didn't actually post the embedded video because it had the, from your point of view, embarrassing based on the fact that you killed Jeff Beck's photos of Hitler and Mussolini at the seashore.
Right.
I thought you wouldn't appreciate that video.
Probably not, but I know. Actually have done that.
Right. I know. Accepted. The point is, this video, I gave the speech, and behind me is visible a enormous Portrait of Hitler.
Right.
Which, you know, obviously, since it was an event celebrating his birthday, it was completely appropriate. I had no problem with it. I didn't address the issue of Hitler in my speech. But nevertheless, it was there glaring down on me throughout the speech.
Was, yeah.
And I thought you wouldn't like it on the front page of Majority Right.
I know you did, but
I put a link to it. Yeah. And everything I had to say about the subject without confines is pretty much in that speech.
Well, let's get a few quotes from it. I mean, I'm going to rely on you to do this. I want to know how you define subject without confines. I want to know what its utility is, what its meaning is.
The subject without confines is just an idea. It's the idea that arises to complete a dialectic. It's the idea that arises in antithesis to the thesis of the idea of the universal object, which is an idea about eliminating all the barriers everywhere between individuals, between countries, between groups. Eliminating all barriers and creating the Mondial dream, the worldwide globalist synthesis, where there are no groups anymore, all barriers have been broken down, there are only individuals, but who are interesting because of their objecthood. They're interesting, they're morally of interest to a moral theory only because, or especially because, they can suffer pain. And perhaps because they can experience pleasure, but because what they suffer, because what could be done to them. And this is why Peter Singer says that chimpanzees and dogs ought to be entities which ought to be entered into our moral calculus, because they can suffer, they're conscious. And when you do that, says Dugin, you are creating a universality. You're understanding everybody as being equal and part of a universal whole. But equal on the basis of equality of objecthood, of ability to suffer. Not because chimpanzees or dogs or cows can do what we can do, but because they can suffer what we can. They can suffer pain, they can suffer thirst, and so somehow they're equivalent. And Dugin says, if we think that this effort to create the ultimate object might call forth its opposite idea, its answering idea, its antithesis, the subject without confines. And it's not clear exactly what that is, but it's something like the idea of a singular universal, that is a universal which happens to be one particular thing and not another. Dugin says,
let me just bounce something off
and
you.
It is, and thus, by trying to create the universal object, the globalists, the mondialists, the moral universalists, will, by doing that, and by thus calling forth the subject without confines, bring about the end of the world. Because it's the subject without confines that carries out the last act of the eschatological drama. Eschatology is the study of the last things. So this is a big deal. But if you wanted to talk in a Hegelian, mysticizing way about the thought that globalism can only logically culminate in the victory of one side in an orgy of genocidal destruction, if you wanted to think about that idea and, you know, hypostasize it, the subject without confines is, I think, maybe a good way to do that.
Would you say that Dugin is explicable outside of the Russian context, or do you think this kind of thought is so detached from the Western canon?
I think a sufficient answer to your question can only be found by a close study of Dugin's more recent speeches. Now, the good news is these speeches are available on YouTube, some of them. The bad news is that they're in Russian.
Yeah.
And so, to answer you, I have no idea. I don't know.
There you go.
But
it's
I don't really care because I'm not interested in Dugin qua Dugin. I'm interested in the subject without confines, as he presents it, just as he was interested in the subject without confines as it was presented by those daft Italian Marxists that he got it from. Mm. Namely, he uses it, and I use it. I use his version, he uses their version, it's just I'm using it. I mean, I understand it well enough, I don't care to understand it any better.
Right. Right. My own feeling is that in its present form, it's too detached to have real value, except to people of high intellect. And we really do need, at this juncture, to be able to explain fairly clearly to ourselves and to others what it is we're trying to do. I think that one risks...
Yes, if you want to talk about, you know, the question of how does one talk to any man, a janitor in a hospital, you know, a farmer digging up turnips, if, you know, how to take the issues that are important to us and explain it to any man to... Now you ought to talk to Alex, because this is what Alex Linder is interested in, and this is his criticism of me.
No, I'm not talking
I don't
about
speak
that.
To the common man. Now look, that's not my particular gift.
No, I'm not
I'm
talking
not
about that. What I'm talking
to
about
the common bloke feel comfortable with
okay,
me.
Okay, what I'm talking about.
Ideas.
No. What I'm talking about is this tendency to cloister oneself. That it is a tendency that.
You know what? I have an email address. People can find out. I have a YouTube account. I'm not cloistered. Anybody can contact me. People choose not to do it. Right? I'm public. If our enemies want to come and martyr me, I have a street address. I have a telephone number. Okay?
Nobody wants
to. I'm not cloistered. I'm not cloistered.
No, you're not cloistered. But
people who are anonymous are cloistered.
The cloister I'm talking about is not a factual real-world situation. It's the cloistering of abstruse ideology, which is then not explicated. And this is something which we've touched on previously and listened. It seems to me that the subject Without Confines is a fine opportunity for cloistered intellects to remain so.
Okay,
I would like to see this quality of depth and intellectualism present in the movement. This is very, very important, but it has to be something that water carriers really can bring down into the forms of political usage. This is how the left operates. This is how the left has been so successful, because their high intellects are in the same general machine as the political activists. Everything, all the water is carried down. And this is something which we don't do well. We haven't got a machine to speak of, but the act of carrying the water and the act of creating the machine are one, I think. And I'd like very much to see...
Why is it supposedly so dangerous to be public? So dangerous.
About,
no one dares to join an organization and start doing the water carrying. It might be dangerous for me to be the only guy out here saying this, but certainly if there are 100 people stood up and started... like carrying and started adapting my ideas and bringing them into an organization, they wouldn't be at any risk at all. No, the reason it's not done is because people aren't interested in the ideas.
Possibly so. In which case, those with the ideas must do more to explicate them and to explain their value. Even the most difficult ideas. Yeah, that's what has to happen. They can't be left.
Well, okay, I'm sorry that I'm not Jonathan.
No.
Rigging Bowden. Okay? All
Jonathan
right.
Bowden. Jonathan Bowden is a wonderful water carrier, and we need, you know, a dozen Jonathan Bowdens. This is true.
But we only have one.
And you have yes. And you have.
There is only one.
You have done something which is a lot more than most of us have done. You've done already a lot more, Soren. The question of whether it's ever enough.
GW perfectly aware of that fact.
Okay. Well, let's just the last sort of area of investigation. Let's go back to how it is that this idea, Dugin's idea, or Dugin's presentation of another idea, an older idea. How did you get to this idea? Why did you pick this idea up? I mean, you didn't just say, "Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I think this is something that you felt is important," but it doesn't appear to be attached to your prior intellectual development. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Hmm.
I'm looking all through this interview for signs of consistency, because that helps me to interpret your contribution.
I would like to quote someone, a thinker, who I have absolutely no respect for, because he actually has the best quote at this point. I'm going to quote Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson said, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds."
Mm-hmm.
I don't waste any effort on trying to appear to be consistent. First of all, nobody pays attention to that except you. Everybody else just notices they don't understand what the hell I'm talking about. They don't worry about whether it's consistent or not. I don't worry about it. There's usually a deeper consistency to what to the things I think, but it usually only appears, you know, later. I mean, very often I notice it years later that there is a consistency, that there are patterns, and that it all makes sense and hangs together. But I myself am the linchpin. I myself am the locus of all my ideas, and they are, in fact, consistent in that they express themselves through me. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes.
Soren, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, GW.